Welcome to Connor Stories, a podcast for people of color, by people of color, and everybody else. I'm Luz Maria Frias, executive coach and founder of The Savvy Coach.
I'm Anthony Galloway, executive director of the ArtsUS Center for the African Diaspora.
I'm Joe Erickson, the producer of Count Stories, and this is a very strange thing because I'm usually on the other end, so hey, it feels different to be here.
We are thrilled that you're here because for the past 2+ years, we've been trying to get you in that chair, so welcome.
I'm here.
And two other co-hosts that normally would be with us, Haleed Lee and Don Eubanks, are stepping away from today's segment to allow for additional voices to join us today.
So I brought some guests today. My guest is Kelly Mitchell. She's the executive director at the Rabina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice at the University of Minnesota Law. I've also got two special guests joining us as well, David Benke and Philip Holmes of Decarcerate Minnesota, which is a grassroots organization hosted by the Twin City Incarcerated Worker Organizing Committee.
Thank you for coming in today, Phil and David and Kelly. We have quite a bit to get through in terms of criminal justice issues and also legislation that is anticipated to be heard during the legislative session, and then some progress that has been made also with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. So we'll start with some distressing statistic that I ran across in preparing for our conversation, which is that Minnesota has the fifth lowest incarceration rate, but the fifth highest percentage of individuals on community supervision, which, if you think about that, that is a staggering amount of people and really just highlights the work that needs to be done in our community. And then the second data point that was really staggering for me is that if all of the prison population across the country were combined to form a city, I should say, it would be the fifth largest city in our country, which is to say that we find ourselves in a period of time where we are over-incarcerating people, but also keeping that level of incarceration, in air quotes, so to speak, where folks are released in the community but not really released from the conditions. So let's dig deeper into that. Let's start by just describing the work that's being done in the community by different entities that we have here, and then we can delve further into the actual issues. So let's start, Kelly, and if you want to describe the Rabina Institute for our audience that may not be familiar with it.
Yeah, so the Rabina Institute is a research organization at the University of Minnesota Law School, and we do research and policy work on sentencing, probation, and parole. And our goal is to really try to bring the information forward that can help with policy change so that people who are experiencing probation and parole and sentencing have better outcomes.
So you provide the research so that policymakers and advocates in the community can work on some of these solutions.
Right, exactly.
This is a very important piece of that puzzle because especially when it deals with incarceration, so many decisions in the past have been made on the comfort or the perceived comfort of communities that aren't rooted in any real data. And so we make decisions that don't actually make us safer. And there's all kinds of examples. And so that kind of research is so important and is part of this whole equation.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you mentioned community because we have folks here from community in the roles that we really need to understand, but also fully hear the voices that are coming forth through that. Philip and David, maybe you can describe the organization and the work that you are prioritizing on, and then we can go further into our conversation.
Sure, yeah. So Decarcerate Minnesota is a union of people in prison, ex-prisoners, family members, and supporters on the outside working across the wall to try to transform the prison system in Minnesota. Specifically, we want to massively shrink the prison population and the supervised population and reinvest that money in making justice work for everyone. So that's who we are and what we're about. And as we'll probably talk about later, one of our big campaigns right now is around technical violations, people being sent back to prison on non-crimes.
And who funds the organization?
We are all self-funded.
Self-funded. And how long has it been in existence?
So our host organization, the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, has been around in Minnesota for 5 years. And we formed the coalition 2 years ago now, specifically to launch this technical violations campaign.
And when you say the incarcerated workers, are we talking about the labor that prisoners are forced to perform and not be compensated for? Or
yes. So we're talking about organizing the people who are enslaved in Minnesota.
Gotcha.
And around the country.
And that's some important piece to talk about. Even in our history of not just incarceration, but in policing, we have a long history of post-Reconstruction, so post the Civil War and the official end of practice of slavery in 1865, huge booms in prison populations in states that were trying to use prison labor to replace the slave labor that had gone, and that reverberates all the way through. And so we have practices today in prisons that harken all the way back to those huge booms.
And in fact, creation of offenses that would automatically then lead to arrests that mm-hmm. would create that population, such as, you know, vagrancies and spitting on sidewalks and things of that sort that were targeting former enslaved mm-hmm. individuals who then were channeled into the prison system.
And we're talking about things pretty egregious. We're talking about things like not being in prison for not having a job, right? Being in prison for not moving across a sidewalk or causing public unrest by the nature of the clothing that you were wearing. Like these types of laws that we're trying to catch folks and put them into the prison system. I just want to point out, actually, David, you know, you and I have worked on some things with youth in the past. And so one of the groups that we took, we actually went to the firehouse where Dr. King used to play. And the fire chief at the time and the police chief had a deal. The police chief owned a bricking company. And the whole firehouse is built with bricks from this bricking company that used prison convict labor. And the saying was, it's okay if somebody dies in this grueling work. We can always get another because the system that was created was so bountiful that I can always count on more labor.
Philip, how did you become involved in this movement?
Well, I was part of another group, which I still am, Power People Leadership Institute. And so they had notified us of David's group, Decarcerate Minnesota. And that's how I got involved with the prison movement.
And when you talk about the Power People Leadership Institute, it's one of those great self-help groups. This is an organization that's run by ex-offenders, and they're there to support each other as they go through probation, which is what we're going to be really delving deep into. The way that organization works is very powerful. I sat and listened to people that have just come in from prison, literally their first day. They got out and they're heading to this organization. And the organization has somehow, through some way, got them accommodation so that you can't be released from prison without actually accommodation. So they're heading from prison to this meeting, and it's powerful because you see them at the most vulnerable with all the expectations of their future. And this group picks them up and gives them some sort of encouragement and this power that they can actually leave the room and feel like their lives are beginning again. If you ever have the opportunity to just be in a room full of ex-offenders and listen to their stories, it was powerful. I must admit, as a journalist, it's hard to ignore those kind of stories because they cut through most of all those human interactions that we all feel. And to have them start their lives afresh is great. But the barriers that they face are incredible. We're going to delve deeper into some of the barriers. I wanted to sort of move the conversation to some of the bigger things that we've had in these last 3 months. We've had some movement, Kelly, on sentencing guidelines on probation. And that's a big thing. So if you could tell us a little bit about guidelines to limit the sentences on probation.
Well, so if we could actually take one step back, I think it's really important if we define probation and parole because they're different. And we want to make sure that everybody knows what we're talking about. So probation is a sentence that could be imposed for conviction of any level of crime. But when you're given probation, you usually serve that sentence in the community. So the court says you're going to be on probation for, 3 years or whatever period of time it is. They list a number of conditions that the person has to comply with. So maybe you have to pay restitution. Maybe you have to do community service. Maybe you have to get substance abuse treatment. But you have to finish those things in order to be successful on probation. In Minnesota, we don't like to use the same words that everybody else uses across the country. So we actually have, instead of parole, we have supervised release. But that's our version of parole. And what that means is a person has been sentenced to serve a sentence in prison. They serve 2/3 of that time in the institution and in prison, and then 1/3 on supervised release. And it's similar to probation in that now you're back in the community, you're under supervision, and you have a list of conditions that now the Commissioner of Corrections has given you that you have to comply with. And it's some of those conditions are very similar to the types of things you might be required to do on probation, and some of them are unique to the prison's setting. So just want to make sure we were all on the same page.
Further clarify the confusion that may be in the community in terms of what are the variables in how a probation time period is set versus supervised release. And where is that discretion and where are those guidelines? Because that'll help us, I think, understand fully this picture.
Right. So supervised release is easy. The most it can be is 1/3 of your prison sentence. And sometimes people have to serve additional time in prison because of disciplinary action, or if they committed something, a disciplinary violation while they were in prison, they might have time tacked on. But the most they're going to serve in the community is 1/3 of their prison sentence. Probation is a lot more variable in terms of how long that could be. And it starts with a statute. We have a statute on the books that says for misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors, those are lower level crimes, probation is going to be somewhere between 2 years and 6 years, depending on the seriousness of that offense. For felonies, up until recently, the statute said that probation could be 4 years or up to the statutory maximum punishment. So when we talk about stat max punishment, we're talking about go to the statute that defines controlled substance offense, a drug offense, and that statute will say this offense is punishable by up to 40 years. So that meant that the judge had up to 40 years available to them to set the probation term. And there wasn't anything that would guide the judge as to what they needed to do. So often what we saw instead was that it was really a matter of like court culture. What was normal in this part of the state? So we saw things like in Hennepin County, where Minneapolis is, 3 years was pretty normal for a felony sentence. But if you went, into the 7th District, which runs from about St. Cloud up to Moorhead along the 94 freeway, we saw 7-year terms on average being about normal. And then if you got into specific offenses, drug offenses or whatever, you'd see those averages go up or down depending on the type of crime. So we saw a lot of variation.
And are the decisions in there, when you talk about that variability, to what degree are those culturally influenced by just the nature of the community or, again, and going back to this public sense of what we think should happen versus what's connected to any real data or practice?
Definitely cultural. You can see that if you sort of look at the averages or the typical sentences that were handed out around the state, you saw pockets of difference. So there was definite variation depending on which court you were in. And, defense attorneys notice this right away because often they'll work in multiple cities or counties, right? So they could see that if I go represent a client in Minneapolis, I'm going to get a totally different response than if I go represent a client up in St. Cloud. So, so they definitely saw that and were raising the alarms ahead of time. And it's definitely cultural. And if you talk to folks within that culture, it's like, oh, well, this is just sort of the way we do it. One of the phrases that one researcher that I know has used is this is sort of the going rate for the crime.
And these are people's lives, right?
Right.
To illustrate that, when I was preparing for our conversation, I ran across a story from Jennifer Schroeder, who had been convicted for a nonviolent drug offense. And her sentence was 1 year, 1 year jail sentence, but she was sentenced to a 40-year probation, which I think to the average person living in our community sounds very disproportionate. And that just illustrates the point that you're making. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. The reality is, if you really dig into the numbers, you know, what you'll find is that most people for felonies were being sentenced to serve 5-year probation terms, 5 years or less. But there's this group of people who were serving really long probation terms. And that's the piece that just felt really out of whack and didn't make a lot of sense, you know, going from place to place.
So when we introduced you as the director of the Robina Institute, but you also have another role.
Right.
You're chair of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
Correct.
For those who are unfamiliar with the work of that commission, can you give us some more background information on that, and then we can move further, deeper into the conversation?
Sure, yeah. So the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, the role of that commission is to establish standards for felony sentencing in Minnesota. So like I said before, the legislature defines the crime, and then they set this high statutory maximum sentence. And we didn't want, Minnesota decided 40 years ago now, that we didn't want judges to have unfettered discretion within that number to set the sentence. So we developed sentencing guidelines that would, based on the seriousness of the offense and the criminal history score of the offender, that would, you know, tell the judge what an appropriate sentence would be somewhere underneath that cap. That's what we do. We are constantly reviewing the crimes that are created and defined and amended by the legislature, and kind of trying to keep an eye on things to make sure that we don't get out of control in terms of how we use prison resources in Minnesota. That's one of the things that's actually really integral to our job, is to keep that number down and to set standards that courts can use.
And to have some predictability and some standardization of some sort.
Right, absolutely. The main values of the sentencing guidelines are that we would have uniformity and proportionality in sentencing. So uniformity means that if you come in committing the same crime and having the same type of background as somebody else, you should get a similar sentence. Proportionality means that, you know, as the seriousness of the offense goes up or as the record of the individual increases, then those are factors that would warrant a harsher penalty.
And a Sentencing Guidelines Commission is comprised of public members as well as professionals. You want to give us just a high-level overview of that?
Right. Yeah, we have the Commissioner of Corrections. We have 3 judges, one from each level. So the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, and District Court, the trial court level. We have a police officer, a probation officer, a prosecutor, defense attorney, and then 3 members of the public. And one of those 3 members has to have been a victim of a felony crime.
Try to kind of give a little bit more understanding to that. Very first time I did time in prison, it was in here. It was in 1977. It's called indeterminate sentencing. So I had a 0 to 5 sentence. Mm-hmm. I did 8 months. I went in October of 77. And I got out in June of 78. I have a friend who got out on what's called a conditional release, which is a very big mistake. You know, people accept that because they're not thinking they're going to do anything else wrong. You want to get out of prison. So they give you a set of conditions. Now, I have a real good friend, like I said, he has been on 5 years probation since 2010. Last I checked, he is still on probation. The reason for that is that once he violates, that time resets itself. And so that is one of the things that, you know, we need work on. I think maybe this cap is really going to help that. I don't know how that applies to him as far as it being retroactive. Hopefully in the future, that'll help people in the future.
Well, let's talk about that. Thank you for bringing that to our attention, Phil. The focus of our conversation, largely speaking, is about the cap that we have been hearing quite a bit about, legislation that had been proposed for a number of years, but wasn't able to make its way through the legislature. And instead, now it was presented to Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines back in November, and then has had a number of hearings, and then we had a result in January regarding this cap. And if that action is not then amended by the legislature or revoked by the legislature, then it automatically comes into effect August 1st of this year of 2020. So let's talk about the reason that this proposed measure came forth, what the opposition to it was, and the need for it as we speak today.
Yeah, so, you know, the variation that we've seen in probation sentences has been an issue for a number of years. And yeah, it had gone to the legislature for a couple of years, I think at least 3 years in a row. I can remember working on bills, and it wasn't passed. Last year, it was a proposal that was passed by the House, but the Senate never held a hearing on it. So it's one of those things where the legislature could change this policy, but there were also things the Sentencing Guidelines Commission could do to change the policy. And there have been times where the legislature and the Sentencing Guidelines Commission have volleyed an issue back and forth. And this just seemed like one of those times where the commission could do something about it. And in fact, the commission, before I became chair, had actually started to take it up, but it looked very promising at the legislature last year. And so they didn't feel like they needed to act. When the bill didn't pass, we voted as a commission that this is actually one of our top two issues this year. So Paul Schnell, Commissioner Schnell, brought forth a proposal in November to place a cap on probation. I actually don't think that anyone in the system objected to the policy. It just came up a little fast within the commission, and we moved it through on a little faster timeline than we typically do. So I think that more of the objections this time around were to the process than to the policy itself. I think that if we had taken it more slowly, we would have gotten everyone to agree to the policy. But I also think then we would be waiting another year for anything to happen. So it made sense to put it through at this point.
I'm hearing you as you talk about the cap. What is the cap?
I'm sorry, I should have explained the policy. So what the policy that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission passed does is we say that for felony offenses that are going to be sentenced to probation, the length of probation should be no more than 5 years. If the court wants to impose a longer term than that, then they have to do a departure, which under the guidelines is a process you have to go through where the court has to justify its reasons. They have to come up with substantial and compelling reasons to put a longer probation term in place. And then that if, you know, those reasons are subject to appeal. So there's a potential for review, even if they put a longer term in place.
And that cap is not absolute. There are offenses that are excluded from that cap,
right?
Correct? We've got sexual offenses, homicides, and criminal vehicular homicide.
That's correct.
Correct.
Right. Those offenses were excluded in the legislation that passed the House last year. Because there had been such agreement with that policy, we felt like the closer we could keep it to that policy, the better off we would be, the more successful the policy would be. So that's how that came to be.
And it's also consistent with other measures coming out of the sentencing guidelines where there is this approach, if you will, that is being recommended or adopted by the commission. However, it also allows a judicial officer to deviate, as you said.
Right.
So it doesn't completely tie a judge's hands if that judge should see a circumstance that warrants a probationary period beyond the 5 years.
Right, that's correct. So the judge still has the ability to impose a longer term for substantial and compelling reasons, but they have to explain that on the record. So, you know, that's where I think we have our power, right? Until this policy actually goes into effect, today a judge can impose any length of probation with no explanation at all. And what this does is it says, okay, look, we're saying that there's really few instances where it should be necessary to have a longer than 5 year term. If you think this is one of those cases, explain why.
And just to contextualize this as well, we're talking about there are approximately 50,000 individuals who are currently on probation for felony offenses in Minnesota, and about 100,000 overall on probation.
Right.
Right?
That's correct.
But we're not sure if there's a number that we can point to for supervised release.
About 10,000.
It's about 10,000. Okay. So we're talking about a significant number of people. So if we think about what has historically happened with these kinds of numbers and how we have only a finite number of probation officers who can keep track of the folks who are on probation, then that gets into all kinds of problems in terms of violations and not providing services that are appropriate in terms of treatment and things of that sort. So help us understand that. Help us understand now the difficulties of what presents itself when someone is on probation.
And I mean, I think the question that actually drew us to this work is, what should someone be sentenced if they don't commit a new crime? What should be the equitable prison time for someone who hasn't committed a crime at all? And it's remarkable that right now, 25% of people who sit in prison in Minnesota are there, and people who haven't committed a new crime, and that's why they're there.
So you're talking about more about supervised release,
also probation
and probation.
Probation, and it's about half probation and half supervised release that are there on non-new crimes, violating petty rules like failure to find housing, like driving a car, like getting on a smartphone, like being late to an appointment.
Or being a jerk.
Having a bad attitude.
Having a bad attitude. This is what hits real home for me. All of my family members and Brother Phil, your experience calls us up. When my stepfather was released from workhouse, we got on several buses to get there, walked a whole long way just to be there when he came out. And we didn't bring enough bus fare because we underestimated and we didn't have much at all. And he gets out and we're standing out there and my stepfather comes out. He's upset, right? That we're trying to figure out how to make money to get back. Everybody's stressed out. Everybody just wanted to be there. And then we're heading back and he gets into an argument with a corrections officer who's coming out. And that was used to call what was going to be his parole officer, who shows up. He's a jerk to everybody. He's got a huge temper and all that kind of stuff. And he's in another 3 months. And so that level of discretion that's there really problematizes things for me, because we have folks trying to exact their sensibilities out on folks just because of their attitude or disposition.
Yeah, that is a big problem. It's a young man, me and David met him about a year ago, who's been violated five times. We met him last March. Keep in mind, he had a job out here at 3M. Seems like every time he gets a job, he gets violated. The problem when you try to make an appeal is that the supervisor up over this particular agent always routinely signs off. Well, I don't see anything wrong with what happened to you. And so there's no objection there. And so this is why people just keep going back. It's really no real legal standing as to why they really, the bar is a whole lot different. So, and that's the heart of this whole matter. He got a job back in the summer. No sooner than he complained against this particular officer, he went back to prison. Now, he just got out last January. He went back to prison on a violation. We still don't know the nature of the violation. But he went back to prison in August. And so he just came out about a month ago. We're trying to get some equity and some fair play in how this stuff is, you know, determined. When you have a whole system that is complicit with just routinely just signing off on people without a saying, well, let's look at this a little bit more carefully. But 9 times out of 10, there's no place where you can go to get a fair hearing.
So what we're talking about there, thank you, Phil, is really highlighting the subjectivity that comes into play with this decision-making process, but also the biases that are intrinsically in there. If we think about the issue of this 5-year cap, we should also clarify for our listeners that there is a basis for the 5 years insofar as it's found through research that very few people reoffend after the 5-year mark as it pertains to the serious offenses, and that 5-year cap is not retroactive, right? So for folks who, as I said earlier, Jennifer Schroeder, who's serving her 40-year probation, she won't be impacted by this. And then lastly, that research shows that having a longer probationary time period does not increase public safety, nor is it tied to recidivism.
Right.
Right. And if I could add to that, I think that, you know, ironically, longer probation terms actually lead to more revocations, not necessarily because people are committing new crimes, but because the conditions that they're required to serve under, the, you know, length of time that they're required to submit to supervision sort of acts as a tripwire. And, you know, just to also, you know, help bring in some of the other issues that are on the table. I mean, those are the same kinds of tripwires that work for people on supervised release. Am I right about that?
Absolutely. I mean, it's heartbreaking to talk to a friend or family member and have their housing lost for nothing, their job lost for nothing, to have to start over, maybe lose trust in a relationship, whatever. And what's also wild is that the Department of Corrections has very good data that this doesn't make anyone safer. In fact, warehousing people, putting people in prison for a short period of time with no services and then bringing them back out, in fact, only makes people more likely to reoffend. So the Department of Corrections is very aware, and they've done very in-depth studies on this, that this doesn't make the community safer. And so it's something that really needs to go, and it's something that we just need to stop incarcerating people for non-crimes on.
And David, you mentioned the issues regarding housing and employment, which are often categorized as collateral consequences. And sometimes I think that's such a sterile term that people really don't understand what that means. Together with that is the issue of voting and not being able to vote during that time. And that is an incredible impact on an individual's ability to navigate society. But also research shows that when you do vote, that you are more invested in your community and more likely to be yourself as a community member. So we can't lose sight of that track. Phil, will you share with us some of your concerns that you might have about other issues that fall into this conversation that we've not visited yet, pertaining to what goes on in prison?
So we have a clip of a mother. Her son, Hardell Sherrell, was found dead in one of Minnesota's prisons. And as a mother, she spent years trying to get some answer from the prison services. So this is what she said. This is her story.
My son's name is Hardell Sherrell, and I'm his mother, Delshia Perry. And my son was in jail on a gun charge, firearm, possession, illegal possession of a firearm. And he went in on August 24th, healthy and happy, considering that he knew he was about, you know, to face his and pay his debt to society for the crime he had committed. And he was okay with that. But on the third day, he took ill. He had fallen out of his bed. He had called me crying on the phone and, you know, saying his back hurt so bad he couldn't stand up on the phone to talk to me. And I was like, oh, my gosh, you know, I knew that it was serious, but it wasn't until days following that I knew it was even more serious. When the next call, he calls me and he tells me, Mama, get a lawyer and have them look at the video cameras because they are mistreating me in here. I was just terrified. And in that moment, I started calling his probation officer. I started, you know, pleading and begging for anybody, the medical staff there, a correctional officer I spoke with. I asked anybody and everybody to go and look at my son and see what's going on, because he has a very high tolerance for pain. And I knew that if he was calling me crying, that there was something seriously wrong with my son. And as you now know, he died as a direct result of neglect, medical neglect, and abuse.
What is heartbreaking about that story is that you can actually see this young man's torment, because there was camera footage of what he was going through. The staff at this particular, well, it's the Beltrami County Jail. Three people have died in that jail. The problem is that they watched this young man going through his torment, drool coming out of his mouth, and they took it upon themselves to determine that they felt he was faking. And so the biggest part about what makes this so tragic is the fact that all of these deaths are occurring, and yet we have to beg and plead and cajole people just for justice for this young man. The system is not working. The system is broke down in this area, where we have to try to figure out how we can obtain justice when justice should be something that comes automatically to us, especially in a situation like this. When it comes to prosecuting people, it doesn't seem like we have a problem with it when we just have an average citizen. But these are people that are staffed at a jail. This situation occurred in September of last year. And yet, we're going around all over trying to just meet with the Attorney General, trying to make justice happen when it should be happening automatically with us. The whole indictment of the system is that we shouldn't have to beg and plead for justice. On the one hand, we see in plain footage of this man lying in torment, in his own vomit, in his own feces. You know, it's heart-rending just to look at that.
The journey for relatives on the outside who are seeking explanations of what is happening within prisons, it's such a hard journey. As you say, as you heard from the clip, she attempted to go to every department, and yet she couldn't get any answers. And I think this is a broader conversation where I think we need to look at the reasons why these things are happening, and also what kind of solutions can we make happen for all the parents out there who are looking for some justice or some help. I mean, I don't know what you would say on that, David.
They won't return your phone calls. And if you have a problem, the only way you're going to get help is if you get together with other people to do it. And we have a system that's built on abuse. It's even in people's legal status, right? People are legally slaves, so they can't form their own organizations. They can get paid less than minimum wage. They have to pay $5, which is, if you make 12 cents an hour, is an incredible amount of money, just to see the doctor. That doesn't guarantee you get anything. Typically, they just tell you, you know, you're fine. You're just faking, whatever. So really, you know, I mean, like many problems in our society, the only way this is going to change is if the people in prison, their family members, their communities, get together and say, this is not okay. And we're going to organize and we're going to shift the balance of power on this. And we're going to be the ones who have the power because we know what the situation is. And we're going to be the ones who drive this solution. And so I think that that's what's so important about organizing with prisoners to change things when we're talking about the prison system, just like any system you want to build with the people who are directly impacted because they know what needs to change.
So I just want to just point out, just for the record here, that Beltrami County Jail is a separate entity than the prison. They're not both within the same system. One's a county jail, one's the state prison.
Yeah, that's an important distinction. And also we have very similar and very egregious medical neglect and deaths in both of those systems.
There is an intentionality of trying to keep this information from leaving the four walls of these facilities, right? So the less that the public knows about this, the better. Because in terms of accountability and checks and balances, they're at least shielded from that level of scrutiny that might come up. What is being done towards that, to change that?
The uphill battle lies in the fact that because these are prisoners, and they can't vote. So, and it's a very unpopular cause in a lot of ways. Politicians don't like to touch it because they don't really have a constituency with guys that are locked up and they can't vote. And so the general public has this mindset that, well, they're locked up, so they must have done something wrong. And so there's a culture that's built into ignoring this type of stuff. And so it's kind of like you said, you know, this shrouded in secrecy is how the DOC operates. And so the information that we have is not really common knowledge. It's very hard to get this information out, and that's why we really appreciate you having us on this program. A big part of this is what we hope is that people will begin to think and to understand what's really going on. You know, when we look at various communities, like, let's say, for instance, an African-American community, there are buzzwords where, to justify a lot of this stuff, they'll say, well, we're trying to keep the community safe. Well, we know that locking people up for testing dirty on a urine screen is not going to stop all the drive-bys in North Minneapolis and all the crack houses that are abounding over there. when we speak to the white community, so to speak, they are astounded at the staggering amount of money that it takes just to incarcerate people. And it's funny because that's where their focus is. When we really illustrate to them, this is why a person was locked up and the cost. Even Paul Snell said, I don't remember the figures, like $250,000 for women that were just locked up out in Shakopee. Just the processing.
Less than 30 days, yeah.
Right. Just the processing of it. In some instances, even his own data shows where they take a person to jail and they get to prison and get released the same day. You know, so all these transport costs and all the rest of it, the feeding and all that, the billing that goes along with that is just staggering. The tax dollars that we pay. And so we have to consider all of this stuff when we talk about this stuff. We can come up with some better solutions to a lot of this stuff, but a big part of it is that right now they have a blank check just to send people to prison, and there's no accountability in that.
And to springboard a little bit off of that, Phil, if we were to look at those tax dollars being spent in that way that is not efficient and doesn't result in any good, and maybe shift the focus and challenge our community to spend those dollars in ways that will actually help people with treatment and programs that will help folks move on and address whatever issues they might have, that we would be stronger and we would have less people going back into the system as well.
Right.
And to put onto the table, too, one of the things that, David, you were kind of alluding to this earlier, is that we have a whole lot of ways to deal with folks before they even get to incarceration. If you were to lead community conversations, one of the things I'd like to put onto the table is that has helped, particularly in Ramsey County, as we're talking about juvenile defenders, there is a long conversation about what do we really need to protect ourselves from? Do I need to protect myself from a kid who's stealing a candy bar? Do I need to protect myself from a kid who was fighting, right? Let's take that. You assume that there's some violence to that because kids got in an altercation, used their fists instead of their words. Kids do that. But I'm going to lock you up for that and lump you in the same category with a kid who actually has really violent tendencies that make folks unsafe. And you're putting locked up in the same space. We didn't even need to lock you up in the first place. We can save ourselves money, we can save ourselves time, and we can spend our time more intentionally. So one of the solutions that even Ramsey County did, and they were so successful at it that they had to close Boys Totem Town because we no longer needed a whole facility because we did a good enough job saying who we really need to protect ourselves from. And if we ask ourselves that question, a whole lot of folks who are in prison now wouldn't be.
And, you know, one of the things we've been working on at the Robina Institute is to really challenge the, you know, judges and parole officers, the departments of correction, to think about the conditions that they impose mm-hmm. when they place somebody on probation or when someone's on parole, to think about, like, do we need those? Or are some of them gratuitous? Or is this like the package of 20 that you like to impose every single time? So number one, think more carefully about what those conditions are. And then number two, think about how to respond when somebody violates one. So like a dirty urine you were talking about earlier, should that be something that results in revocation? Or should that be a signal that this person's struggling with addiction and we need to do something different with them? You know, so that's things that we have to build into this process.
And let's also talk about the technical violations and a movement for that as well as we close up our conversation.
Yeah, I mean, so we've been in negotiation with Paul Snow of the Department of Corrections for the last 8 months, and they have all the power to do almost everything we need on these things. We're also bringing a bill to the legislature that would stop a whole set of different types of violations, say, you should not be sent to prison for these. It just doesn't make sense. And that's something we're going to ask the legislature to do, but also, like, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, if the legislature doesn't do it, we're going to take back to Paul Snow and say, hey, you have the power to not send people to prison who shouldn't be there. So that's important. Another thing that's being changed in partnership with Paul Snell that I think is positive is right now, if your parole officer says, hey, you should go to prison, 100% of the time they give you a warrant, they hold you in prison, they hold you in prison for 2 weeks. So you lose your job, you lose your housing. Even if you win the hearing, which again is a kangaroo court, so it's a mess. But even if it was a just hearing and you win it, and some people do, your life has already been ruined. So something that they've committed to doing now is they're going to actually use the law, which they were supposed to be using before, which is to give people a summons, not a warrant. And they're also going to start using an impact tool so that the parole officer has to justify that sending this person to prison and making them lose their job and their housing and their church connection and their family is worth sending them to prison. So we'll see what that actually looks like when parole officers implement that. But that's something that I think is positive, and that's something we definitely need to build on. But with a lot of these things, whether it's the abuse in prison or the abuse outside of prison, it's because people have unchecked authority and unchecked discretion to do harm. And so that's really why we need to come back to these things of taking things off the table. You should not ever be sent to prison for being late to an appointment. You should not ever be sent to a prison for having a bad attitude. You should not ever be sent to prison for being homeless. Like, this doesn't make sense, and it needs to not happen.
So you've got movements that are happening. You've got these positive developments. How do I get involved? Where do I go? Like, what's the landscape of the work to address these things that folks can on-ramp on? I mean, I represent a whole community of churches in the African Methodist Episcopal Church that could be marshaling and rallying around this. So where do I get involved?
You can find us on Facebook at Twin Cities Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. You can email us at tc.iwok@gmail.com. That's IWOC. We're also building coalitions with organizations who also do criminal justice work to try to line up the forces. And we'd always love more people on the table to really push this stuff.
We'll list those sources on our Counter Stories Facebook page to ensure that people have that information. And there's also some upcoming legislative hearings that will be happening actually this month, February 25th.
So are there some bills moving forward right now that folks should be aware of as well, right?
Yeah, so the Less is More bill is the bill that basically does what I just said. It would take a lot of violations off the table for incarceration. It significantly reduces the amount of ability for people to be held in prison for lengths of time. It stops people from having this loophole right now where they can just re-extend them for a year and a year without doing anything new. It would also incentivize people to behave well, to reduce their time on supervision.
And that bill has not been jacketed formally in the legislature, which is a technical term that says we don't have a file number on it yet. But the chief author is Representative Dean, and in the Senate it is Senator Bobby Joe Champion. So look out for that, and you can go on the legislative website and key in those keywords, less is more legislation, and we should be able to figure out then when it gets jacketed and it's set up then going forward.
If you're interested in influencing sentencing, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission meets monthly. Schedule is on the website, but we meet monthly and we do take public testimony at every hearing. But certainly also just, you know, we've had compelling letters submitted that say, hey, we would like you to work on this particular issue. And I can't speak for everybody else on the commission, but my personal view is that if an issue comes to our attention, we're going to talk about it.
Well, thank you for an incredibly enlightening conversation and insight that you all shared. I want to just leave us with a thought that our penal system, when it was created, dating back all the way to the founding of our country, was founded on a concept and principle of rehabilitation, which is to say that we had designed a system that incarcerated individuals not for life sentences, not for unduly burdensome times, but it was for a time for the individual to go in, receive services that would help this individual rehabilitate, come out, and reintegrate into society, and not have a scarlet letter then that follows an individual for 40 years by way of a probation or any other type of stigma, and not to then be ostracized by these quote-unquote collateral consequences that makes it impossible for folks to find employment or find housing, and certainly deprive them of their right to vote as members of our society. We leave now with that in mind, just a food for thought that we should really be grounded on the real reason that we have a criminal justice system in our country. I'm Luz Maria Frias, executive coach and founder of The Savvy Coach.
Anthony Galloway, Executive Director of the Arts Us Center for the African Diaspora.
Joe Erickson, producer of Counter Stories.
David Banke, Decarcerate Minnesota.
Philip Holmes, Decarcerate Minnesota.
Kelly Mitchell, Executive Director of the Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice.
Thank you. We'll see you next time.